Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Katie Galley, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And this is going to be a very important one because it touches on a subject that's important to a lot of people, a lot of our listeners. Mm-hmm. Katie?
Yes.
How you been?
I've been good.
You seem very fired up.
Very fired up.
You had a good day today?
Yeah, it's Wednesday morning.
You know, you start your day, I didn't know if our listeners are aware, at like 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Right? Then I used to be impressed by that.
You used to be.
I used to be.
No longer.
And then I read an article about Mark Wahlberg. He gets up at 2:30 in the morning. 2:30.
He's trying to
while you're
one-up
sleeping.
Me. I'm sleeping. Man.
He's working.
What time does he go to bed?
7:30.
Oh. But so it's give and take, I guess. Man, I got to get up at 2.
There you go. Moving the bar. Moving the bar.
Yeah.
All right. On today's Atlanta Business Radio, we got a guy who's been here before, David King. He's with Alexander Haas. And David, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Tell us a little bit about Alexander Haas. How are you serving folks?
So we're a fundraising consulting firm, and we work with clients all over the country, really, helping them primarily improving their fundraising programs. So annual giving, major giving, capital campaigns. We're not a direct mail firm or a telemarketing firm. We're mainly in the direct relationship consulting sort of business.
And then do you work mainly on the overarching strategy of how to raise funds, or are you actually kind of boots on the ground, helping them actually raise funds?
We don't actually solicit gifts, but we're very hands-on. So we do develop overarching strategy and plans, but our firm ethos is that you got to get your hands dirty with this. And
right.
So we'll be in there working with everyone on the staff to help them improve and sort of an all boats need to rise with the tide mentality.
But it's more teach a person to fish. Strategy.
Absolutely. We are teaching to fish is what we're trying to do. And you know, we hope that we come in, that we help somebody. We typically get involved either when somebody hits a plateau in what they're doing in their fundraising operation and they want somebody to come in and take a look and see if we can get them back into a growth situation, or when somebody's planning to do something that's outside of their normal operation. So, you'll hear about an organization having a capital campaign to build a building or expand a building.
Right.
Or colleges and universities. We do a lot of work in the college and university sector. And those tend to be, you know, very large campaigns, hundreds of millions, even billions of dollars that spread across the campus. But that's not something those institutions do every day.
Right.
It is something we do every day. So they'll bring us in to help with that kind of strategy and execution because it's an expertise.
Now, is it true? Is there a trend in giving to nonprofits that when the economy is going well, then more money flows to them? And is that true?
It is true. It's actually very tightly correlated, although in a lagging way, to the S&P 500.
Really?
So if you back up giving, if you look at a chart of giving over a long period of time and look at the S&P over a long period of time, back the S&P up 12 to 18 months, the trends are exactly lined up. It's a very good correlation.
So now, since the economy has been going well and the S&P 500 has been going well as well, is this a time where nonprofits should put the pedal to the floor and just say, okay, now we got to really do this because at some point it's going to swing back?
It's interesting that you say that. I was with an organization last week talking about getting ready to do a capital campaign, and the executive director said multiple times, we need to do this before the next downturn. We need to do it now,
right?
Because we know, you know, I don't know what I was watching, something yesterday where somebody said winter is always coming. So
there is Game of Thrones.
Yeah. So there is a sentiment out there that things are good, and things have been good for a while. So
right.
So the fundraising world and the world of philanthropy has been robust for several years, but I think some people are looking at it and starting to think, wow, you know, if this might be the top, so we better get
right
out there and do what we need to do.
So now, when you're working with the nonprofits, you mentioned universities. Is it run the gamut, like from churches, hospitals, education? Like, is it anything goes when it comes to nonprofit?
Pretty much. I mean, there does have to be a certain size level before it really makes sense to hire us or anybody like us. So we tend to not work with organizations who have if it's an annual giving kind of thing or an ongoing fundraising, they need to have an annual budget of about $1 million. And if we're going to work on a capital campaign or a large campaign, that's sort of the minimum level too. And it's not that that those organizations don't need help or that we don't know how to help them or that we're biased against small organizations. It just comes out to the fact that if they're trying to raise $500,000, then our fee structure is going to eat into that pretty significantly. And it's just hard to justify on our end or their end spending that much of the money on getting advice.
So then so the people you work with tend to have been around a little bit and have more of a kind of a higher budget.
In the traditional nonprofits and the educational institutions and the arts institutions, definitely. We do a lot of work with churches, and that's a different animal altogether. Most churches do not have even a part-time person whose job is come in every day and think about fundraising. It's more episodic, and there's still a lot of call from the pulpit fundraising going on. And so,
is that a missed opportunity in your mind?
I think it is a missed opportunity. And one of the trends that's happening in giving, if you go back and look over the last 30 years, 30 years ago, giving to religion was more than half of all giving in the United States. Last year, it was 30%. And it's been on that trend line from 50 going down to 30 over the last 30 years. And there are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of demographic reasons that people will point to. Certainly, church attendance is down in the United States.
Aren't there more churches, though?
There are more churches, and there are mega churches, which didn't exist 30 years ago.
And online churches.
And what the demographics people will say is that millennials and the Gen X don't affiliate that way, that they're not affiliating with churches, and that's part of the problem. And I think that probably is an issue. But I think the larger issue is the church sector of the nonprofit sector is the last to professionalize its fundraising operation. So you just don't find a lot of churches who have someone whose job is to think about every day, how do we raise this money for the budget? Now, the church I go to has about a $4 million annual operating budget. Any other kind of nonprofit in this town that has a $4 million budget that is almost entirely dependent on donations to meet that budget will have multiple people whose full-time job is to raise that. But you just don't see it in churches. And I think as we've gone to over 1.2 million nonprofits all competing for money, almost all of the other ones having professional staff and devoting some full-time attention to it, that I think churches are sort of losing market share because they're not fighting for market share.
But is it an example of one of those where you have some industries that are laggards when it comes to embracing whatever technology or whatever it is, and they're kind of the last to get around to it, and at some point they're going to make it a more professionalize some of their tactics or their strategies in order to do this, and then they'll all fall in line?
We are seeing churches add a development or stewardship type person to the staff. It's coming along very slowly. There are still some people out there, and particularly in the church subsector, who feel like fundraising is sort of a dirty business and they shouldn't be in it, even though they have to be in it. So you'd see some resistance that way. But it is, we do see more churches adding development staff like that. But that's one of those places where when we get hired to go in and do a capital campaign for a church, they may not even have good data on who their regular attending members are. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, when we go into a museum or a university or something, they have good data and lots of it. They know who their donors are. They have relationships. There's lots to work with. So when we go into a church, we tend to have to do a lot more handholding, a lot more teaching, and we're fine with that, and we're happy to do it. And our structure for how we work with churches is set up for that. Whereas if we go into a university or a large cultural institution or even a large human service institution, they probably have staff who are pretty talented, who have been in the field for a while, who know what they're doing, and our job becomes more strategy and guidance and problem solving, and not as much we have to physically sort of, you know, take them to the water and show them how to drink.
Now, what about the tactics of grants and things like that, where you're asking the government for money or institutions for money? Do you help in that regard as well?
We don't get very involved in the government grant process. We're heavily involved in helping our clients work with corporations and foundations.
Like family foundations?
Family foundations, even larger institutional foundations, and certainly corporate giving. But we really don't get very involved in the public funding side. That's almost a different specialty. I mean, you can imagine how complex some of these public funding grant applications are. It's also one of those things that it can be a little like trying to play catch with Jell-O. We've had a number of clients who had situations where they were promised that they were getting money from some particular government entity and they were counting on it in their planning, and then an election happened. And
that can change the prioritizing of the grant monies.
The people who were advocating for them or even made the commitment to them are suddenly gone, and now the money may be gone, or you may just have to start over from scratch relationship building and try to do it. So it's something that's, this is going to sound bad to anybody out there listening who works in government, but we always tell our clients, if you've got a government grant, don't count it until the check clears. Because we've just seen so many of people plan on some kind of government funding, only to have it get negotiated out in the process of politicking. Right.
So now, how do the tax laws impact giving and fundraising?
That's an interesting question. The tax law changes, there's a lot of conversation in the sector about the tax law changes that went through at the end of last year. There are a number of economists who are predicting that the increase in the standard deduction, that alone might cause a 5% decline in giving. So a 5% decline in giving is over $20 billion. So we're talking about,
it starts adding up to real money.
That's right? Real money, yeah. And they base that on the fact that, we're going to go from about a third of the population itemizing deductions to about 5% itemizing deductions. So they say, their thinking is, if people aren't itemizing, then they're not really getting the deduction for their charitable giving, so they'll quit doing it. And the formulas that they've created, and these are all really smart people, all point to that same conclusion. I don't agree with that. From my 30 years of working with people, I've rarely found a donor who woke up in the morning and said, you know what I need today? I need to give away some money for a really good tax deduction.
Exactly. Let me maximize my tax. Who can I give money to? Yeah.
I think...
That sounds like an accountant.
It does, yeah. And it's
that's not like a real life.
And also, when you think about it, too, giving away money is not a way to save money. I mean, yes, it's an amount that you don't end up having to pay the tax on, but you still
spend the money.
If I give away $100, I'm out $100.
Right.
Yes, I don't have to pay the tax on it, but I don't have the $100.
Right.
But I think giving
it's more emotional than
it's
that.
It's an
isn't
emotionally
it?
Driven activity. It is not driven by tax. I mean, is it nice that when you give the gift, you get to write it off your taxes so you don't have
to
pay?
Right, but that's not the driver.
But that's not what drives it.
Is that what you found?
It's belief in what...
The cause, right?
And really, when you really... All the surveys they do, when they really boil it down, making a difference, helping people, that's what it boils down to. I saw a statistic the other day as I do some writing for Forbes magazine, and I was writing something about this tax law thing, and so I was doing some research. So there was a study that was done at the end of last year that said 96% of Americans plan to make a charitable gift last year. And
that's of all socioeconomic levels?
Yeah. Based on their survey data, that's what they came up with. Now, last year, under last year's tax laws, about a third of the population itemized their taxes and took that deduction, which means around 60% of people plan to make a gift even though they weren't going to itemize and take the deduction. So if the economist's premise that less people itemizing is going to kill contributions is correct, then it should have been correct last year and the year before that and the year before that. But if this study is right and 96% of people plan to give and 60% of them aren't itemizing, then
they were going to give anyway.
Yeah, then the tax deduction is irrelevant to that decision-making process.
Now, do you find that at the heart of most people giving, especially at large levels, is it because it feels good or they believe in the cause, or is it, how much is it like their legacy that they want to be known for something other than, you know, maybe their work? Yeah.
There's a little bit of all of that, and it's very, very personal. And that's, you know, one of the things that we work with our clients to do is to try to approach every donor as an individual, because I've worked with people of extraordinary wealth and extraordinary generosity who didn't want their name on anything, mm-hmm. who made most of their giving anonymous. And
what percentage is that?
Maybe 20%. And it's really because they don't want it to be about them. You know, they're doing it. That's not why they're doing it. Now, right. I've also worked with people who you had to have a really slam bang, shiny, bright, great naming opportunity, or they really weren't interested in having the conversation. And obviously those are the extremes, and the rest of us float somewhere in the middle where we might like our name on something, we might not. So there are certainly individuals where the legacy by leaving their name or their family name on something is a motivator. But for most people, that alone is not enough. You know, it's great to, it may be great to have your name on something, but if you don't believe in what the organization does, if you don't think they're doing good work, if you don't trust them to take whatever this amount of money is and use it wisely to execute what they said they were going to do, then they're not going to give to you anyway. Just getting their name on something, you know, isn't enough. They have to really buy into and believe in the organization.
So then a tactic to get in fundraising then shouldn't be, I wouldn't think, then make this menu of things. It's more custom than that.
It is, although you'll almost always see a menu of things, you know, available. There's typically organizations doing building campaigns will have opportunities to put names on rooms and things like that. If you look at materials you get for annual giving, there's usually different levels that they have some kind of, you know, you're in the benefactors club or the 3-star club or whatever. So that's still, I mean, it is most definitely done. And people do respond to it. For some people, it's just, where do I fit in? You know, they look at this list and the gifts start at $5,000 and go down to 50, and in their own mind, they're going, well, I may not be the 5,000, but I'm not the 50. So where do I notch myself in here?
Now, they're deciding by on those menu type choices, they're deciding like, oh, what goodies do I get at this higher level? Is that
it's usually not goodies as much as almost like a social status sort of thing. Where do I want my name listed when this list comes out at the end of the year?
Right. Am I part of this group or am I part of this group?
So there's two fundamental decisions that have to be made with any donor going through a process of deciding to give. Number one is, am I going to give at all? Is this an organization I believe in supporting, that I want to support? You know, am I going to give anything?
Okay, so that's binary, yes or no.
Yes or no, yes or no.
So once you're in the yes pile, choosing amongst.
How much? How much am I going to give? How much of a priority is this for me? Most people give to between 5 and 7 different organizations. So if it's something I haven't given to before, am I slotting it in as an additional one? Am I moving somebody else out and this one's taking over that? Am I taking the pot of money now and instead of dividing it by 5, I'm dividing it by 6? Is this something that is...
Is that how people think, that they have a pot of money that I give, you know, $10,000 and I divide it up amongst these groups?
I don't know that they necessarily do it as easily as here's my pot of money divided by the number of groups. But I think most people do approach their annual philanthropy with a capacity number in their head. This is how much I can give away. Mm-hmm. And then they make decisions about how to divide it up based on a lot of factors that vary from person to person. How much do they care about the organization? How long has the relationship been? What's the money for? Is it just going in to keep the lights on, or is it some special new computers in every classroom that I'm really excited about? You know, what's the project for? I think there are a lot of factors that weigh into that how much, and I do think it's a very personal decision. It's a very personal
thing. Is there any
thing.
Counsel, though, for the individual? Because it seems like in your life, especially if you have some wealth, there's all these advisors kind of buzzing around you, right? You got your accountant, your lawyer, insurance people. There's a lot of people that are trying to help you. Is anybody there helping you with your kind of nonprofit strategy, or is that just a personal thing between the family?
It tends to be a personal thing within the family. When somebody else gets involved, it tends to be an accountant who's coming at it purely
from a tax standpoint,
or how much, you know, what would be the most effective asset to give? Should it be cash, or should it be appreciated securities, right, or land, or how should you do this? But it does tend to come at it more from a tax and accounting. But
because of that, it seems like you were saying about the churches not having a sophisticated strategy, it seems like the individual doesn't have a sophisticated strategy either. They don't really have somebody kind of counseling them on the best way to get the most bang for the buck. Maybe it's better to give more to fewer than it is to spread a little out to many.
Yeah, and I think that I don't think a lot of people approach their philanthropy that seriously. I think they give away money because it makes them feel good. It's an emotional decision. But I'm not sure that they really sit down and think through it
the impact.
Like they might, they may be thinking through the impact, but they may not be thinking about it as, you know, how should, if I'm going to give away this money, how, you know, what's the best way for me to do it? Is there, you know, should I rotate and, you know, and give each organization gets a different amount every year and I'm going to rotate the top one in? I think we're going to see people though, begin to get a little more serious about it with this tax law situation. Because mm-hmm. one of the things that I've seen a lot of emails from accounting firms floating around to their individual clients, suggesting that if they believe that they're going to be standard deduction filers going forward, but they have a history of making charitable contributions that they want to continue, that they consider bundling their contributions. So let's say this year, I normally give $2,000 a year to charitable organizations, and that and the other stuff, the way the tax laws limited taxes and other things I can deduct, is not going to get me above $24,000, so I'm not likely to itemize. Well, what the accountants are saying is, if that's the case, what this year give $10,000 in charitable contributions, that gets you up above the standard deduction, deduct it all this year, and then for the next 4 years, don't give anything and just take the standard deduction. So, you know, that requires some advanced thinking,
right,
some knowing what's coming down the road. It requires some liquidity to be able to do that. If people begin to do that in earnest, it's going to require nonprofit organizations to rethink some of the things they do as well in terms of how they handle and recognize donors. You know, one thing that you see at a lot of colleges and universities, some other kinds of nonprofits too, but it's a really big thing done in colleges and universities, is consecutive years of giving. So they'll have recognition societies for consecutive years of giving, and when you hit some milestone, 10, 20, 25 consecutive years of giving, they'll actually make a really big deal about it and have an event and honor those people. So if we move to this scenario where I give you $5,000 this year and then take the next 4 years off, can I tell you, I want you to count that as $1,000
a year
for the next 4 years? You know, how are organizations going to respond to that kind of request? The other thing is, I don't want to get too granular and too much in the weeds here on fundraising stuff, but a lot of attention is paid in development offices on lapsed donors. So a donor who gave last year and didn't give at all, or hasn't given yet this year, or gave 2 years ago but we haven't gotten them back as a donor. So there's a lot of attention paid to donor retention. But if you have donors bundling and only giving periodically, it's going to really complicate how we evaluate what's a lapsed donor look like. Because this person who hasn't given in 4 years may look lapsed, but it may be because they're on an every five years
cycle.
Yeah.
Right.
And we just haven't, you know, that hasn't been the mentality, hasn't been the way we've had to think and process gifts. So it's, if that starts to happen, it's going to change that. It's going to change how we recognize those. It may change some accounting practices. And, you know, is that going to be treated as revenue, deferred revenue, that they don't actually start right. counting until the years when the donor said to take it? You know, how is all that going to play
right,
out?
Then now the nonprofit has to adjust their planning.
And it could create, you know, I mean, in a scenario where a big segment of an organization's constituency randomly all decided in 1 year to bundle.
Right, so it's good for that 1 year.
Big spike 1 year, and the next year you fall off the cliff. But it's there. But, you know, you better
manage your money right.
You know, don't get crazy with the bonus, right? Don't go out and buy a new car with the one-time bonus because you may not be able to afford it. And I think, I think that kind of situation is likely to have more of an impact with a smaller organization where it wouldn't take that many people bundling to really skew a year than it is with a really large organization. But it certainly could happen.
So now for all organizations, it sounds like the basis of fundraising is kind of their mailing list, right? Like you have to have a concerted effort to keep track of the people that have given or that could give and really kind of work that list.
Yeah, the database is
the lifeblood.
Incredibly important. It's very difficult to raise money if you don't have any donors.
Where do you start? Like, if you're starting from scratch, do you just get the board members, friends and family? Like, you just kind of build out from there?
It's sort of the old thing of expanding concentric circles. You know, you start with the people closest to you, and you get them to contribute first and buy in, and then you ask them, do you know anybody else you think would be interested in what we do? And you build it out, and you build it out. 20 years ago, you would go out and you would buy mailing lists. So if you were an environmental organization, you'd go and buy National Geographic's mailing list.
Right. If they subscribe to that magazine, they must like nature. Yeah. So then maybe they'll donate to us.
And if you were a Georgia organization, you might just buy the Georgia list. But if you were a national organization, you might buy the whole thing. And then you would just start mailing to those people. And you would hope to get a 1 or 2% response rate. And that would be considered good. You'd spend a lot of money to do that, but over the lifetime of those donors that you're acquiring, it's going to be the payout is the ROI is great. But nobody opens mail anymore, right? So that now, you know, when 1 or 2% response rate to those kind of mailings used to be considered a really good response rate, now, you know, 0.25%, 0.5% response rate to something like that is considered a good response rate because we just people don't respond to it as much as they used to. Telemarketing used to be a big donor acquisition thing. You know, all the phone people used to complain about, you know, I'm using air quotes here, people, this is not TV, the phone calls at dinner.
Right.
And so the shift from home phones to cell phones has changed the dynamic on that as well. You're not finding people sort of at home at dinner time anymore. You may be calling them where they are, when they are. And increasingly, people don't answer the phone. I'm guilty of this. If my cell phone rings,
and it's a number you don't know,
if you're not in my contact list, leave a message.
Exactly, and I'll figure out if I'm going to call you back or not.
Absolutely. And we used to do this with the old answering machines at home too, but we could hear who was calling. Right. If we were sitting on our sofa ignoring the call, we could hear it. Then you don't get that now. So you get, even for the firms doing telephone fundraising, the number of reaches is dramatically down, which means the number of attempts they have to go to get a live person on the phone is higher. So there's a lot of things like that, but still that, your donor list, that is the lifeblood. And one of the ways that we work with our clients, there are a multitude of ways I could reach you if you're one of my donors to ask you for a gift. But probably send you an email to ask you for $50,000 is not one of them, So
we've got to figure out other ways.
Appropriate strategies for appropriate gift levels. Right. Yes, if I want $50, I could probably send you an email and that would seem reasonable and a reasonable way to contact you, and you might respond to that.
Right.
Especially if we have some existing relationship, and I'm asking you to do it because I believe in it, and then you're going to come back in 3 weeks and ask me to do something else,
right?
Yes, there it goes around, comes around. But you have to look at this list and say there are people giving us $10,000 a year, and we're certainly not soliciting those on the phone or by email. We need to be visiting these people. When you look at these gifts you hear about where somebody gave, $50 million, $100 million, $10 million, numbers with lots of commas and zeros. Those gifts happen over the course of multiple conversations. Typically they result from years of working together.
Right, it's not an
together.
Impulse.
They tend to not be in. I mean, there are certainly going to be examples we could find of impulse gifts at that level. But generally, They're strong relationships that have been built over time, and that gift has been negotiated. And I'm using negotiated here to mean there's been a dialogue about it, not that it's been an adversarial sort of negotiation, but that gift has been negotiated and worked out over multiple face-to-face conversations. And so with our clients, you know, what we work them with is deploying the right fundraising tool for the right level of donor. You can't go meet with every $50 donor face-to-face, and you can't be emailing $50,000 donors asking for gifts at that level most of the time.
And then, again, that's a strategic kind of counsel. That's not like, here's my e-book on fundraising.
Correct. That's, you know, that's getting in and, again, getting your hands dirty. We need to look at the donor list.
Let's look at the list, and let's kind of sort them. At the different levels they're at.
And let's send it out to a company that'll come back and give us wealth ratings on them. You know, what they're giving to me may not be an indication of what they can give. It may just be an indication that they're not as they're not as into me, that I haven't asked them for a gift that would cause them to give a larger amount, that I haven't gone out and met them, and we just don't have that. I mean, there are a lot of reasons that somebody might be able to give a lot more money than they are to me. So just looking at my own, or I might just have a terrible fundraising program, right? So just looking at what people are giving to me and making those decisions is one part of the process.
Right, but it's in a vacuum. You need to get a more of a holistic view of all their fundraising.
So what we want to do is we want to send the list out to a wealth screening company and have them screen the whole list and come back and give us wealth ratings on everybody in the list. And then we can sort it from top down. We can overlay it then with the organization's data and say, all right, here, look at these top 20 people. You know, out of these top 20, seven of them, you know, haven't given you a gift in 5 years. They're probably gone. You probably lost them. But these other 13, they're still giving, and they have the capacity to give you a whole lot more than they are. So now, person by person, let's come up with a strategy to build our relationship with them.
And then this is what you're doing, right? You're talking to, okay, let's talk to Mary.
Yep.
Okay, this is the stuff she's given to. Her family's name's on these six buildings. How come you haven't asked her to put her name on your building?
Yeah, and, you know, what's she interested in with us? What do we see in giving patterns with other organizations?
Right.
Is there something that, you know, is she particularly interested in women's issues, and we happen to be building, you know, a center for women's studies or something, you know? So we look for those connections, not just what has she done for you, because that again gets back and introduces an environmental element of what have we asked her to do. If we can look even broader and say, what is Mary doing with her philanthropy more broadly, then we may have something that would fit just perfectly into what she's interested in, but we didn't know.
And she wasn't even aware of it.
Right, because we didn't tell her.
Right, it wasn't really a true line of communication.
So it really is at the top levels, you know, with the top, for most organizations, the top 200 to 400 donors, we try to get really, really specific with that and really look at individuals and really try to find out what they're interested in. And the best, you know, we talk about the work that we do is really development work, that the job is really developing relationships between individuals and organizations. And that fundraising is one little point in time in that cycle. You develop the relationship. You find out that you have some shared interests. You have a program that's addressing the shared interests. You ask the donor to support it. Then you've got to, then you don't, you know, walk away from the donor and never talk to them again, right?
Exactly.
You have to thank them and steward them, and you have to follow through on what you told them you were going to
do. And ask them their input of, hey, you know, what do you think? What do you see? What would you like to see? I mean, have a real kind of relationship with them, not just look at them as a bank.
Exactly. Don't treat donors like ATM machines.
Right.
We say it all the time. You know, you have to have a relationship, and you have to steward that relationship and think about it. Think about your work, your development work as that, where fundraising is a moment in time where we ask somebody to give. But if that's all we're ever asking them to do, they're going to get tired of it pretty quickly.
And then for you, how do you go about getting your clients? Is it just you're going out there and developing these relationships? Because it would seem like it's a similar strategy for nonprofits and for-profits.
We try to go on Atlanta Business Radio as often
as
possible.
That's how every day.
you know, there are 1.2 million nonprofits in the United States.
But that's small and large, or those?
That's
are the
all.
Ones
that's that, all of them. So there's a lot of those who are really small and are never going to.
But that's the vast majority, right?
Work with small. Some of them, yeah. So we're pretty. You know, we try to be pretty targeted. And you know, consulting is an interesting thing to sell because you're, you know, if I come to you to sell you consulting and you haven't decided you need consulting, then I'm basically coming to you and saying, I know more than you do, so you should hire me to tell you, which is not a great way to sell anything.
Right.
So what we try to do is we try to be visible and have the name of the firm in front of all the subsectors that we work with in the nonprofit community frequently, so that when somebody comes to the point where they begin to think we could use a fresh set of eyes, we're going to launch this new project, right, whatever the case may be, that if we're not top of mind, we're at least, you know, three bullets down in their LinkedIn feed or their Facebook feed or their Twitter feed, you know, that we're easy to find when they get to that point.
'Cause ubiquity is, I think, the new marketing, is you have to be there when the right.
I think it's especially true if you're selling something like consulting that's episodic. I mean, we have clients that we might work with for 4 or 5 years, but we don't have a client we've worked with for 20 years in a row because they don't need us for
right,
that.
Right, because all of a sudden they have enough money for a while, so yeah, we'll take a break. Like I said, we still love you, but when we need you again, we'll call you again.
We get them through plateaus or special projects, and then they don't need us for a while, and that's okay. That's right. What we do. That's our business. But we do need to be... You know, we do a lot of repeat business with people more so than organizations.
Right, because the director of one organization
leaves. The average tenure for development officers right now in fundraising is 16 months. So less than every 2 years, people are changing seats.
Right.
So people ask, do you guys do a lot of repeat business? Yes. We work with a lot of the same people over and over and over again, but at different institutions.
Right.
So we're constantly trying to be out there and establish ourselves as knowledgeable.
The, and the go-to people in the
yeah.
space.
We know what we're doing. We've done it for a lot of people. We're good at it. And when you get ready, you know, when you need it, we want to be easy to find. So
right.
that's really what we do. We do some, you know, we go to conferences and do some sponsorships, and certainly we
and
do
speak and you're
speaking
and you're writing all over the place,
yeah.
articles everywhere.
We're blogging and we're newslettering and we're vidcasting, which is I was calling it a podcast, and my 13-year-old daughter corrected me the other day and said it's video, it's a vidcast. So it's a vidcast. So we're doing all of that stuff just to try to be top of mind so that when people do reach that point, we're easy to find,
right.
you know, and then we try to be responsive, you know, and help them if we can and point them to someone else who can help them if we can. And that gets into the smaller organizations. You know, part of being ubiquitous, is that you do have people find you who are really
aren't
not
the right fit.
They're just not a good fit. And I hate to have somebody who's found us, but we're just not a good fit, and just ignore them or sort of leave them out there hanging in the wind. So I'll usually circle back with anybody who contacts us and tell them we're not a good fit. And if they need reasons why, I'll go through that. But we don't think we're a good fit. But either here's some other people who I think are, or here's the kind of people I think you should be looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And usually in those situations, if I don't know, if they're in a community where I don't know somebody specifically to direct them to, I'll tell them you really shouldn't be looking at firms like ours. You really need to be looking at somebody close to you who's a one or two person shop who can really give you a lot of attention and can do it at a price point that makes sense.
Right.
And at least give them that profile that they can begin to ask around and look around in their own community and try to find some help.
Now, if somebody wanted to learn more and have more substantive conversation with you, what's the website?
It's www.fundraisingcouncil.com. or alexanderhass.com. You can misspell either of those and you'll still get us. Because we had a lot of people who thought we were a council, as in a group of people. So C-O-U-N-C-I-L. We
you
had
got
to
buy them all. You had to buy all
we
the
had
URLs.
To buy all those URLs. Because I had, you know, people say, I emailed you 5 times. It's bouncing back. Where are you sending it? So we've got that. We also do, I mentioned the vidcast, so I'll mention that. We do, it's completely focused on nonprofits, and we interview nonprofit leaders really from around the country on a wide variety of topics. And you can find that at www.futuresinfundraising.com if you're interested in that.
Good stuff. David King, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Katie Galley. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.